Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the War Report. And for those of you, this is your first time, we welcome you as well. We have a very special guest, and I know I say this every time, but so far I've been very lucky to get some super people to come on and be our guests and have a conversation with. And today's guest fits right into that mode. But before I announce him, remember last year this time, my first year on, I decided to use the entire month of May as Teacher Appreciation Month, as opposed to the 1 week that is normally given nationally for Teacher Appreciation. So I'm going to do that again this year. And today's guest fits right into that mode of celebrating a teacher and sending this all out to all the teachers, past and present and future. This is your month on the War Report. Our guest today is none other than Dr. Jesse Turner, a.k.a. Jesse, the Walkman. Those of you who are in the ed community, you already know who he is. I don't really have to say too much about that. But I will say for those who are coming in maybe for the first time or who are coming in and don't know about this gentleman, he is, I have to be very careful. I select my words here. I want to say infamous, but that's not what I mean, Jesse. Very famous for some of the things that he has done, both in the ed community and the larger world in terms of human and civil rights activities. He is an activist personified. And with that, Jesse, welcome to the War Report.
Salutations, James. Happy to be here.
Okay. Is it infamous or famous?
I'd rather stick with humble.
You won't let me do that to you. Okay. This is something I've been doing with him a long time, folks, so he was ready for it. Okay. Jesse, give us that elevator pitch as to your background for those people who don't know about you.
Sure. I'm Jesse Turner. I'm a professor of literacy, early childhood education, and elementary education at Central Connecticut State University. I've been the director of Literacy Center for the past 17 years, and that center has provided over $500,000 worth of free tutoring to struggling readers and writers under my direction. And it's been a beautiful, beautiful time. My PhD is in reading language and culture from the University of Arizona. And I'm the walking man, and I guess I've been fighting for things that are just and right my whole life. I've been an educator for over 30 years, and from the very start, I've been fighting for equity in our schools, not just lately, my whole career.
Yes, and again, for those of us who know you, we know that long history that you have engaged in. One of the things maybe I should point out is that you just returned from Selma. You want to speak a little bit about that?
Sure. No problem. As when I was 8 years old, I was in D.C. that August when Dr. King spoke. So I was in D.C. with my grandfather, a Union steward, and it kind of shaped and molded the life that I was to live and grow into. My family has always spoken up on issues of justice, but Selma's just a natural place. Selma's, that's the old civil rights community, so it's not the slick suits that you see on TV every day. Selma are people who are real great civil rights activists, Rose Byer, Bernie Sanders, so many others. But I go to Selma for the simple reason that you have to stand up. And our voting rights, I started going 5 years ago because with the voter suppression laws that are going on, I don't see us moving forward. I see us moving backwards. We hear about compromises on the voting rights bill, and I'm like, what do you compromise? You don't compromise morality. You don't compromise the right to vote. So I go to Selma to support my brothers and sisters there and the right to vote and for justice, and I do that all the time. I love being a part of Selma. Nothing's better than crossing that bridge, and this year, you know, Reverend Barber was there, powerful, the president was there. It's, I think we crossed the bridge with at least 150,000 people. It took me 4 hours to walk, probably a quarter of a mile. So you know how crowded it was, but it was such a beautiful moment, you know, and I love it. Education is civil rights, and civil rights is education. That's a Save Our Schools message.
Oh, okay, you got that, Ann. I'm going to play the role of the everyman, the everywoman who doesn't know about you, who doesn't know what's happening in education, and maybe don't even care. So from that vantage point, I'm going to ask you some very basic elementary questions to try and bring people up to speed. And for those who know you and know of you, I think it will also be enlightening for them. You did your first walk. When to D.C.? I know, but when?
The first walk I did to D.C. was in 2010. We had had 8 years of No Child Left Behind, and those of us that really followed the data were in the data, and what we had was 8 years of massive failure with No Child Left Behind, and I had hope for some change with a new president, a new Secretary of Education. I had hope for a new direction. And when Secretary Arne Duncan entered into that, the United States Department of Education, what I found was not change, but a man who would make testing even more, greater focus of his policy and inequity a part of his policy. You know, I wrote letters to the president. I spoke up at State Department meetings, at anywhere I could. And finally, I just decided that I needed to walk. I needed to walk because that's what we did in 63. My grandfather and I, it took us hours to reach the mall, the Lincoln Memorial, to hear Dr. King. You know, that's what we do in my family. We walk, we protest, we hold our signs, we speak up. It's healthy. I had to do something because silence and apathy is not acceptable in our nation, especially when we create policies that are massive failures that are doing tremendous harm to our children, our teachers, and our local schools.
So,
in 2010,
that was motivated by your perception of we were going backwards as opposed to going forward under the new administration, and you wanted to bring attention to this. How did it go, that first walk?
My walk took me 40 days. It's about 400 miles. I went, you know, it goes through Connecticut, through New York, through New Jersey, through Pennsylvania, through Delaware, through Maryland, and right into D.C. And while we didn't have a million people, I did meet people in every one of those states. And sometimes they walk with me, but they always shared their stories. And what I discovered in Connecticut, in New York, in New Jersey, in Pennsylvania, in Delaware, in Maryland, and D.C., that our children were spending 8 to 12 weeks practicing, preparing, and taking these tests. These tests that the results don't even come back to the following year, so in essence, they are useless. And I have a little model, you know, testing is not teaching. So if we add up 8 to 12 weeks over the course of 13 school years, you can realize how much learning our children are missing.
And the situation hasn't changed. We have a couple of callers that are waiting to come online. Let's bring in that first caller.
Jennifer from New Haven.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you?
Good.
Okay. What is it that you'd like to either ask Dr. Turner or myself?
Well, I'd like to put the question out there about the whole idea of the corporate reformers kind of co-opting the term equity and fairness when it comes to education, and his comment on that.
Jesse?
So, one, you know, we have to be realistic. If your reform is new standards and testing, well, that's not a reform. That's what we've been doing for over 100 years now. So, yes, Jennifer from New Haven is correct. They co-opted the word. They stole the word reform, and instead of giving us reform, what they did was they gave us more of the same. We have 49 states in this nation that spend more money on their wealthy schools than their poor schools. Now, if you want reform, I say take that on. What testing and standards will not change the inequity that exists and dominates our public school system. So Jennifer's right.
Okay. Jennifer, do you have another
Thank
question?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Have a good day.
We have a second. Thank you. We have a second caller.
Well, this is Bob George. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, fine. Hi, Bob. How are you?
Hi. I work with Jesse and in this cause. And at this point, you know, I spent time with Jesse and Selma this several months ago, and the Voting Rights Act had been gutted, and it has been gutted. And in many ways, the word civil rights is something that we need to look at in terms of not only the Voting Rights Act, but also the rights of our children to a quality education. And Jesse and I have worked on this a lot together. And I have to congratulate Jesse, first of all, on the first march, which made a huge difference in people's awareness, and the plan for this march, which we'll be supporting it from Save Our Schools, along with the BATS and Opt Out. And Jesse, I'd like you to comment on the closing of schools and the opening of charter or contract schools, and what that does to the rights of the families and the communities there, where their schools are closed.
Sure. I'd love to discuss that. First of all, any kind of education reform that is rooted in the closing of our local public schools is not reform, but an attack upon local community. That's first of all. Second of all, we need to look at what these private contract schools do. We need to look at the data. I look at the data, and if you follow the data, you find out that only 17% of the students who attend charter schools do perform better than the children they leave behind. That means 83% either are outperforming them or doing just the same. And how could we call a reform that is only less than 20% effective, a reform? I mean, if this was the military, if this was a baseball team, if this was an athletic team, you would be kicked off the team. And these people have spent billions and billions of dollars on schools that are less than 20% effective. So it's a shame. Every time you close a school, a local public school, you lose your neighbors. what do I know about these new charter schools? No one knows anyone. The neighborhood gets destroyed.
So I just wanted to interject that in Chicago in particular, we've suffered through and had devastation in our schools with more than 100 schools closed over these past 10 years. And now the district is, even though they promised not to close any other schools, they're doing an offer to put a contract school rather than a neighborhood community school, a high school, into the historic Brownsville neighborhood. And folks, we're going to need your support across the nation because it's going to be a fight to keep a democratic open enrollment neighborhood school in Walter H. Diet High School. I just want to let people know about it.
You know, what's funny about that, this whole thing, not funny, but what's sad, is that in 2010, the NAACP came out with a resolution opposing charter schools as a reform that would bring equity. And when we look at the current data on charter schools, we find they are the most racially isolated schools we have. So when we're thinking about the damage or the lies that is done, saying we're doing this for poor people, we're doing this for children of color, and then we wind up with more racially isolated schools, schools that don't even have a 20% success rate, schools that are costing us billions of dollars, schools that are damaging communities. You know, it's where is the Democratic Party that ignores an NAACP resolution opposing these reforms? It's a shame.
Let me try to finish what I was going to say about the reform. Go back to the end of the 1990s, in that era, there were two movements that were going on that comes out of what we refer to as neoliberalism, one of which was strengthening the standards, and the other one was the choice movement. Those two movements, they both failed miserably their first time out. They went back to the drawing board, and they looked at, Jesse, what is your and my favorite, the civil rights movement. And they studied what made that movement successful. They borrowed or co-opted the language of the civil rights movement, folded it into their individual movement, and they came out with what we call Standards 2.0 and Choice 2.0, using the civil rights rhetoric. They did the same thing with the word reform. They have absolutely no intention to reform. Reform means to work within the structure that exists and to improve it. From the very, very beginning, the Choice 1.0 as well as 2.0, their motto was to destroy public education and then build up from the ground a new privatized system. But they didn't say that. Propaganda would not fly that way. So they use the term reform. And hence, the public is told, we are reformers, just like the previous efforts to reform schools, and we're going to make things better in terms of the outcomes that students achieve. But we're not going to tell you that we're going to close schools down, turn around schools, take over schools, get rid of the community school, the teachers, redistribute the children across boundaries. Oh, and we're going to send them to this new thing that we call charter schools that are so much better than what you had before. To understand it, if you understand the term propaganda and all of its meaning, I think you'll have a much clearer idea of what the turnarounds are about, what the mislabel or reform is about when you start connecting all those dots. Okay, we have another caller, so I'm going to say goodbye to this you and bring in our next caller so we can get back to Jesse.
Thank you.
And Thank you for calling, sir. Okay. Do we have our next caller?
Hello?
Hi. Who am I speaking?
Hi, my name is Crystal Smith, and I reside in Baltimore, Maryland.
Oh,
can you hear me?
Hi, Crystal. Yes. I read a lot of your posts.
I just wanted to... Same here. I just wanted to say, am I hearable right now?
On my end, yes.
Okay. So I just wanted to touch on a couple things, messages for the grassroots people. We definitely need to focus on things like organization, it's a collaborative process, inspiration, original thought, for instance, like my idea with the, plastic golden camel on the roof of my car. It may seem crazy, but we need those sorts of things and to bring joy and catch people off guard, essentially, so that they're, like, wanting to know more. Also, another very large thing we have to really think about is safety. We have these events, and we're going to have more events. So we have to remember to work with, local law enforcement and that sort of thing to put safety measures in place. So, we all must remember these things. Organization, inspiration, safety, we all have to step up, too. Everybody believes that they can't do nothing or that, somebody else can do it. Each person can take the opportunity and go, I'm going to do whatever I can. Another thing real quick, language, it's a tricky thing. If we nail ourselves down to specific language, like, for instance, whether it be, religion or politics, those sorts of things, we're not going to be able to create the impact that we need to do. So not nailing any one specific, like I'm Democratic or I'm libertarian or I'm, Christian or I'm Jewish or any of these things, we have to be able to evolve and use everybody, together as one and get those different ideas and perspectives. So language, we have to really pay attention to what because we can inspire, but we can also cause unnecessary and ripple effects that could be very damaging. So, organization,
okay.
Inspiration, safety, those sorts of things. And thank you.
Okay.
And remember to have fun.
All right.
You have a wonderful day.
Jesse?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Okay. Crystal is one of those people that has reached out to me, and we have had communications, and she's one of those people that I'll meet on my walk, and she's planning events in Maryland. We have Beth Apperger. We have Mona McDermott from United Opt-Out. There are liaisons all along the way that will be helping the guide to walk, and Crystal's a wonderful person who just wants me to know, Jesse, it's going to be safe for you to go to Baltimore. Of course, it's going to be safe, But she's just a wonderful person, and one of those spiritual people who are all about goodness and stuff. And I'm looking forward to. We have never met face to face. It's been through Facebook and email, so I'm looking forward to that. And she's right. We don't need to identify ourselves politically. We need to identify ourselves with this idea that children are more than test scores, that a public education is something that's bigger than the politics, than the religion, than the communities we live in. It can become a place that unifies us all. And I'm very, very much afraid, James, what you said before, that this is a plan to end public education as we know it and to create a privatized system where our children become the profits of privatizers. That's a frightening thought. And that's one of the reasons I'm walking.
Okay. My position... And you kind of stated it pretty well. The privatization, what I call the privatization of everything and everyone, that's, to me, is the end goal here. And public education just happens to be in the crosshairs, not accidentally, but specifically on purpose. for a lot of reasons, and I always tout as one of the first reasons, is the amount of money involved. And since this whole effort to privatize is all about the money, not about education itself, if you understand that, if you're aware of that, a lot of what's going on, I think, becomes a lot more understandable. So with that, let's move now to where we are now. We've looked at your first walk. Why did you decide to do a second one? Wasn't the first one painful enough? No, keep going. I'm joking with you.
Oh, no, I'm fine. The first one, walking is something that that I like to do. Now, I'm a big guy, you know, and so whenever I get ready for my walks, I lose weight. I have to get healthy. I got to prepare for them and stuff. I do like to eat some of them fried, fatty foods, but I got to take them off the menu. But, you know, other than that, the first walk inspired the Save Our Schools movement that brought Mac Damon, Diane Ravitch, Jonathan Kozol, and so many other speakers. They all came on their own time, and it brought 10,000 people to D.C. So when I'm looking at this walk, I think it's time. I think something inside me says the reformers are being recognized as deformers. And everything they are doing is falling apart and ready to crumble. So I'm walking this time because it's time somebody walks in the Department of Education and overturns the money changes. Rupert Murdoch looked at our schools and said it is a $500 billion market annually. These people have looked at that. There's 53 million children that attend our public schools, pencils, papers, books, lunches. You get the idea. They have seen it, and yes, they want that piece of the pie. And they're after it. They're after it. And the strange thing for me, James, is you hear them talking about data, data, data. And the data that they chase, they're looking to see if little Johnny or little Jenny is proficient or not. And then they'll label them. If you're in 19 states, we won't allow you to graduate from high school. Even if you got all A's in your classes, we'll hold you back if you weren't proficient on their test over there. And they're looking at this data. Now they want to analyze teachers and use test scores to evaluate teachers, and teachers that don't even teach reading, writing, and math. These tests are in those isolated areas. So even music teachers are being held to this, history teachers, science teachers, gym teachers, and they're being told they're going to be evaluated by the reading scores of their students. But, James, there's something this nation has to understand. We have spent $1.2 trillion on these reforms, and they're utter failures. So in the PowerPoint that I sent, I hope people go through it, there is the Reading First Impact Study, one of the most rigorous research studies ever done in American education. It looked at Reading First was the gold Cadillac school that the United States Department of Education set up. They trained their teachers. They made sure they adopted one of their five golden programs, and they guaranteed children would become readers. 6 years later, that program, what we discovered was the only group that showed growth was the control group. The children that were exposed to the Reading First reforms actually lost comprehension in the first grade, the second grade, and the third grade. We spent 6 years of $6 billion. And I'm always saying, let's look at your data. Was anybody fired? Was anybody dismissed? Did we have any congressional hearings? No, we didn't. Reading First ended only because the General Accountant Office found discrepancies in it about the people that were giving out the grant monies worked for the companies that either sold the testing or the materials to those schools. But, I mean, there's data, and nobody's paid. Nobody's paid for that. But we're holding children accountable, and we're holding no one in D.C.
Jesse, this first study, was it publicized? Did it get out to a wide audience, or was it buried?
And think think about it, it was put up on the United States Department of Education webpage, but nobody publicized it. Valerie Strauss at the Washington Post and some other bloggers, Anthony Cody at Education Week and a few others pulled it out. And there's a number of people that follow these things. James, I'm a data junkie. I look at the data. I believe the data is informative and can help us. But nobody in Washington wants to shake this money tree. And so they just buried it. They just acted. They went out, and they all of a sudden the Reading First program disappears. No announcement. No one held accountable. I've got teachers in Atlanta, person facing 7 to 12 years for changing the numbers on a test, and I have no one in the United States Department of Education held accountable for wasting $6 billion in 6 years of time, and also for putting people that awarded the grants on those panels that would award these grants that work for the very companies that would profit from the tests they sold to them and the materials they sold to them. So, James, you know, it's a cabal of corruption.
There was a second study that you wanted to talk about.
Yes. Yeah. So if we look at
three, so this is two more to go.
Sure. So the first one, the interim report was secretly released, not secretly, but quietly released in an interim report at the end of the George Bush final after the election was over. They held it into after the election. They knew the data was negative for 6 years, but they held it back. And the final report of that came out the following year when Obama was in. And President Obama and Arne Duncan should have looked at that data, should have looked at that study and knew what happened. But what they did was rather than be informed by the data, they doubled down. And Arne Duncan had a new Cadillac program. What he would do was he decided that the fifth graders, what they would have is a reading across the content and a supplemental reading program. And they would get the five Cadillac programs that are guaranteed, once again, they're always guaranteed to succeed, always cost us millions and billions of dollars. And then they did that for a year, the fifth grade, and then they really expected the data to be positive. And James, the data on that one, again, it comes out to be that the only group that showed any growth was the group that got none of their reforms. Their students in the that received one of their five reform programs, all of those students lost comprehension. So that's the 2009 supplemental reading programs. And then they did it again in 2010 for the sixth graders, because again, these people, they're not looking at the data, they're not listening to the data while they're blaming our schools and closing our schools and complaining about our parents and our students and our teachers. They're not looking at their data. So the 2009 supplemental reading program came back with the same result. The sixth graders, the only ones that showed growth, were the ones in the control group. And it's important for listeners to understand the control group means I didn't get your treatment, I didn't get your medicine, I'm the only one, and they're the only ones that benefited. And all the ones that got their treatments, those students lost comprehension. So when we look at those three studies...
Let me interject right here.
Sure.
Difference between experimental group and the control group. Both groups, in terms of theory and practice, should be identical in characteristics so that by separating them, you're basically taking one group that was composed of identical characteristics and splitting it into two groups. The experimental group gets the treatment, in this case, the education program that they were trying to get, whereas the control group, they get the regular standard, whatever program that they were supposed to get for that period. By making them equal in terms of various characteristics, one can then supposedly theorize that if you found a difference, and if that difference was significant, it was because of the treatment, versus if you don't find anything, then you say that the treatment itself was ineffective because the results were very much close to what the other group got without the treatment. So that's a very important distinction, is that the experimental group is exactly what it is. They are the one that's experimented on. But they are also very much like the group that was not experimented on. So you're trying to isolate the effect or the impact of the experiment itself on two identical populations, but only one gets the treatment, the other doesn't. I hope I didn't confuse anyone.
I think you have it right. I mean, I know you have it right. And we have to look at something that's a part of medicine. Medicine, if you do an intervention, you create a treatment, you have two basic principles that must be followed. If you don't follow them, they will put you in jail, pull your medicine off the shelves, pull your treatment off the shelves. And that is, first, to do no harm. The second is your treatment has to have a wellness component. So by the very nature of focusing on your measure of education as a standardized test that will determine who succeeds and who doesn't succeed, you're violating the first principle of do no harm, because some students will fail these tests, and those students will face punitive implications over this. So they violated the do no harm. They're violating the wellness, because if you have 19 states that use these assessments to keep some students from graduating, even though they may have learning disabilities, even though they have been successful in their academic performance at the school and you hold it back, well, there's no wellness component to that. So in many ways, James, we are talking about something that's evil. And then if we immerse it in what they're doing with the Common Core now, with the PARC assessment and the FBAC assessment, see, in medicine, I need to ask you if you'll be a part of the study. We pay people to be part of the study. Our children on their parents are not being asked. They're being told they must participate in these experimental assessments, because the current assessments are not validated, are not normed. In essence, they are experiments that have not been validated. And we're forcing them, our governors, our United States Department of Education, we are spending billions of dollars and forcing assessments on parents that have not been validated.
Justin,
it's evil.
One word. Mangala.
You got it. It's
Dr. Mangala unleashed.
That's
for
it.
For those of you who may not know that term, during World War II, German scientists were totally free to experiment on human beings at their leisure. They would all kinds of experiments, try and figure out how to make the perfect human being, the blonde, blue-eyed, Aryan race that Hitler wanted. And the person who was leading the program is Dr. Mengele. They did horrific experiments on people. Did operation without anesthesia. They cut off limbs and tried to sew them on the other side of your body from the left side to the right side to see how it would... You name it, these guys were able to do anything that they wanted to do. And for the purpose of trying to find again what makes that perfect human specimen, male specimen, that Hitler called the blonde, blue-eyed, Nordic Aryan. Well, I think what Justin is saying is we're doing the same thing here. We're doing things to children without parents' awareness. We're doing things to children without having had the test itself being validated. We are, as I think Gates talked about, we won't know the results of any of this crap. And I'm using that word, Justin, because you're on the show. I would normally say something else, but... Oh, we don't even know the results of any of this shit that they're doing. But he said 10 years from now, we might know. So 10 years, we're experimenting with the nation's children. And the first principle of the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm, does not exist in these people's vocabulary or their minds. Is that an accurate sort of like summary of what you were saying, Jesse?
It's very accurate. The very nature of the assessments we are using come out of an American eugenics movement that focused on labeling and sorting and determine who was worthy of giving birth. And when they looked at that in the American eugenics movement, they were fearful that America would not be able to compete. What were they afraid of? They were afraid of people of color. They were afraid of immigrants. They were afraid of people who didn't speak English. They were afraid of poor people. And they thought if we could somehow weigh them intellectually, we could find the ones who can breed. And if we found those, then we could control the population. And we have to remember that the American eugenics movement sterilized nearly 70,000 American women in the name of that reform. So it goes, it's connected. It's connected to that. I begin every single conversation with parents, my teachers, anywhere I'm at. I always say this. I say, are children more than test scores? James, I have never heard anyone say no to that. Everyone says they are. And the conversation we should be having about right now is, well, what are they? And for me, they're marvels. They're miracles. They're worthy of our love. And we should be nurturing them like we do flowers. We should be watering them. We should be feeding them. We should be fighting for equity in those 49 states that are spending more money on their wealthy schools than their poor ones. If people can't recognize the eugenics in that, and by the way, the American eugenics movement was exactly what inspired the stuff that went on in Nazi Germany. Hitler loved it. It fed him.
Hitler read material written by American scientists while he was in house arrest when he's a little corporal in the First World War I. And he started corresponding with the American eugenics. But eugenics itself started in Europe and England, derivative of Darwin, and then Darwin's, I think it was his nephew, who picked up his uncle's work. But that was called positive eugenics then. They were looking for ways to positively mate men and women so that they could produce people who would be perfect for the upper class. That's what they were looking for. But it was also volunteer program. When it came across the Atlantic to the United States, they went an entirely different direction that are now we call negative eugenics. Hitler, while in prison, learns about it. He corresponds with Americans here. When he gets out of jail, when he rises to power, many of the Americans here supported him financially, long-term business contract with some of the big corporations that supplied equipment for the German machine to process the people that they were sending to Auschwitz and Buchenwald, you name it. I'm going to do a show on that, Jesse. Been planning it for over a year. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to rant on it.
No, it will be a great show. There are connections that people need to see. But for me, the final straw with this No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top, Common Core state standards, whatever you want to call them, the kinds of things that these ed deformers are coming up. There is one piece of data that not only says strike three, you're out, but the game is over, and that is that our high school students' SAT scores are at the lowest level in four decades. Now, James, the current high schoolers have known nothing but these reforms. These reforms began in elementary school, then they moved to middle school. Now they're moving to high schools. And all you hear these reformers have said is college readiness, college readiness. And in reality,
The reforms have not made anyone ready for college. It has had the exact opposite effect. And we somebody in Washington has to be held, and not only in Washington, in every governor's mansion in the nation, someone has to hold these people accountable for their data. And their data is an overwhelming failure. This education reform of No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top are the most massive education reform failures in the history of public education. They have wasted over $1 trillion with nothing to show for it. And we have to be careful, because they're reauthorizing the Elementary and Secondary Act. And the same, I don't know, crew that gave us NCLB is again saying they want to make high-stakes testing the center of the universe of their reforms. And we can't let that happen. Our children are more than test scores. Our children deserve equity. With $1 trillion, James, here's what we could have did. We could have told every college student who went to university over the past 13 years, we could have said, it's absolutely free. What we're going to do is for 10 hours a week, volunteer at the school, we will pay for your education. We could have did that. We could have given, we could have had summer academies. We could have hired 500,000 tutors and sent an army out into our schools. But we didn't. We spent our money on paper and pencil assessments that arrive a year later and are absolutely useless.
I don't know what to say, because I'm in total agreement with you, every syllable. And I want you to, we're running, oh, maybe 5 minutes left now, but I know that there are three takeaways that you want to let everyone. We still have a caller. Let's bring that caller in. Hi, caller.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. And you are?
Hi. My name is Sheila Ressiger. I'm calling from Rhode Island. And I admire Jesse so much. I want to thank you so much for all that you've done. And I want to get back to what you mentioned earlier about the civil rights groups, about the NAACP opposing the charters. And I'm very concerned and upset that many of the civil rights groups have come out in favor of the annual testing. They seem to be in favor of the charter schools. They seem to have either been co-opted or for some reason bought into the corporate ed reform mantras. And I'm wondering, you know, what we can do about that. What is your thinking on that?
All right. One is it's one of the reasons that I enjoy going to Selma every year, because at the Selma Jubilee, just 2 years ago, we put charter schools on trial. We put charter schools and tracking on trial. And by tracking, they mean that kind of, we're labeling kids smart, not so smart, tracking who goes to college and who doesn't. And they use a mock trial. And what we did was, you use real judges, you use real lawyers, and they're famous judges, famous lawyers. And they provide a case. And so we, the charter schools as a solution to saving black children. And Rose Fire, a civil rights lawyer, she fought that case that the charter schools and the jury is the audience. And when you go to Selma, you go to the mock trial, it's packed. You don't have any place to sit. You're standing in the walls. Everybody comes to it because it is the place in Selma that we bring those people who never come to justice to justice. But Sister Rose, what she did was Rose said to them, well, we got this resolution, and that's one thing. And she asked, why do we have a solution that's like sending lifeboats to save our children, but you don't send enough lifeboats? There's something wrong with it. So not every civil rights group is backing these charters. No. The old real-time civil rights community is saying no to them. So I think it's important to separate them, and I think we can convince the others. I'm glad you called up, though, and brought that up. I have hope.
Yeah,
Great.
I'm also glad you called, and we thank you. We got about 3 minutes left, so caller, you can stay there and listen to us, or we can say goodbye. Hopefully, you'll stay until we're off the air. Jesse, I know that there are three points that are, one, driving you for this second walk that comes out of your first walk, but they also related. Tell us what those three points are before we run out of time.
Sure. For the richest nation in the world to have an Education Week quality counts report that indicates 49 states spend more money on their wealthy schools than their poor schools is absolutely unacceptable. It is immoral. And for me, everyone should be in the streets. That's one. The takeaway should be that no matter what these deformers are calling anything, we first have to address the inequality that goes in our schools. And the second takeaway is we have to recognize the rhetoric behind these reformers that claim that they've got ways to save us, such as, the young lady from Rhode Island mentioned the charter schools. 17%, only 17% of those children are doing better than the ones they leave behind. Unacceptable, unacceptable. One in five is not a success. It's a failure. If you were on any team in athletics, you would be kicked off. So that's a takeaway. We can't allow them to say charters are succeeding. The data's not there. And another piece, we need an alternative vision for public education. And I think there was the pastoral letter on federal policy for the Mutual Call for Justice by the United Churches of Christ. I mean, there's over 40 million people in there. They wrote a letter to the president and the secretary of education telling them that competition is not the answer, that you can't get social justice by forcing children, teachers, and schools to compete against each other. That's not justice.
Okay.
That's called the rat race.
Jesse, we have less than a minute. Just let me say this. One of the three things that you said and wrote me about is, one, simple concept, testing is not teaching. Two, top-down education reform has always failed. No Child Left Behind is a massive education policy failure in the history of public education. Agree with all of those points. I had something that I wrote for you. Maybe the title of your next blog or your next book would be, I am my test score not. Let me repeat. I am my test score not. I think that summarized almost everything that you've been talking about this hour, your writings and your walks and et cetera. Folks, we are out of time. This is what happens when you get someone like Jesse and you get the callers coming in. We get carried away, and next thing you know, our time is up. This is the first show for this month on teacher appreciation. Sorry we ran out of time. We could have Jesse back maybe before he does his march, but today we have to say goodbye. And with that, have a great Sunday, everyone, and see you or listen to you, hear from you next week.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.